Healthy Alternatives. Both research and real-life experiences are making it clear every day that our traditional medical system and practices need to be rethought, revised, and recharged in light of a more holistic approach to health. Dr. Jerry V. Teplitz, host of Healthy Alternatives, has been a pioneer for 36 years in stress management and optimum health. With a Ph.D. in holistic health sciences, a law degree, and as the author of 8 books, all focused on health, stress management, and performance, Dr. Teplitz is uniquely qualified to help us explore and incorporate healthy alternatives into our daily lives. He is a professional speaker and has shared his wisdom with over 1 million people. Join him to reach your highest level of health and wellness. Now, here's Dr. Teplitz.
Welcome to Healthy Alternatives. I'm Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and you're listening to WebTalkRadio.net. What Healthy Alternatives is about, most of us really want to reach optimum levels of health and wellness. We want to feel better, live longer, and enjoy life even more, and that's what I attempt to do for you on each of the Healthy Alternatives shows. My guest I'm going to be interviewing a little later is Dr. Mary Newport. Dr. Newport has been trained in pediatrics. She has worked at Medical University Hospital in Charleston. She's been founding medical director of Newborn Intensive Care Unit at Spring Hill Regional Hospital. And she's also been married, and this is the important part for this interview, to Steve Newport, who started suffering from early onset Alzheimer's disease. And she's written a book called Alzheimer's Disease, What If There Was a Cure? The Story of Ketones. And we're going to be talking to her about this really amazing cure, which is a unique thing to say nowadays for Alzheimer's. We'll be back with Dr. Newport in just a few minutes. Every week, I like to begin the show by talking about an issue or concern you should know about because it can have a real impact on you. This week, I want to talk about cell phones and its danger to your health. And this is a chunk of it is research from Dr. Deborah Davis. She wrote the book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, and she's been researching the safety hazards of radiation emanating from your cell phones. Now, Dr. Davis explains that the biological impact of your cell phones is not actually related to its power, but rather to what she calls the erratic nature of its signal and its ability to disrupt cell resonance and interfere with DNA repair. I want to share a story with you that Dr. Davis shares about a woman who had no other risk factors for cancer that came down with breast cancer. It turns out the woman tucked her cell phone into her bra. And the cancer specialist who took a look at her cancer quite literally connected the dots because the cancer was in a number of places in the breast, and the pattern of cancer lined up perfectly with the shape of her cell phone. What you want to do is actually avoid carrying your cell phone anywhere on your body because this radiation type exposure happens within 6 inches of the antenna. Research published in 2009 showed that wearing a cell phone on your hip may actually weaken an area of your pelvis where it's located. What the researchers did is they measured pelvic bone density in 150 men who regularly carried their cell phones attached to their belts, and they carried their cell phones for an average of 15 hours each day and used the cell phones for an average of 6 years. And what they found is their mineral density was lower on the side where the mobile phone was carried. Other studies have found that cell phone radiation can affect men's sperm count and the quality of their sperm as well. Last year, an Israeli research group reported a sharp increase in incident of parotid gland tumors over the last 30 years. These are, it's a type of salivary gland located closest to your cheek. And it's the same area where people typically hold their cell phones. And they found a 4-fold increase in cancers, these cancers from 1970 to 2006, while the rate of other salivary gland cancers remained the same. The World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer has actually classified cell phones and the radio frequency electromagnetic fields coming off it as possibly carcinogenic humans. And children probably at the most risk because the cell radiation penetrates so much deeper into their brain because they don't have as much brain mass. And in the midbrain where it can hit, tumors can actually be much more deadly. Even pregnant women need to be careful with cell phones. Researchers looked at data from 13,000 women, and they found that those who use mobile phones were 54% more likely to have children with behavioral problems. And when the children began using cell phones themselves, 80% were more likely to suffer from behavioral difficulties, 49% were more prone to problems conduct. So cell phones, as much as you can, I know that's saying a lot today, you want to keep them off your body, keep them away from you, and use them as minimally as you possibly can. If you want to know more about me, Dr. Jerry Teplitz, you can go to teplitz.com, T-E-P-L-I-T-Z.com, and you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I do a free monthly e-newsletter called The Teplitz Report. It's health, nutrition, wellness oriented, usually things I don't cover on Healthy Alternatives. You can go to teplitz.com, click on the About Home button, you can sign up there. Every week, I also like to talk to you about a healthy breakthrough. It's the newest discovery, as latest information can have a positive impact on you, your family, and loved ones. When somebody breaks out with herpes, doctors will tend to prescribe a cyclovir ointment or other topical medications to treat the outbreaks. New research has shown that honey is actually a better remedy. It works faster and it has fewer side effects. We may not be aware of it today, but before antibiotics came about, honey and sugar were some of the best natural wound healers and infection fighters you can find. When they started to treat patients with honey instead of cyclovir, they found the overall healing time with honey was 43% better than a cyclovir for sores on the lips and 59% better for genital sores. What they did in the research, they had 16 adults with a history of recurrent herpes in various areas. And so by putting the honey on at least four times a day, they were able to have this positive impact. You do want to make sure it's raw honey. And there's an even better honey from New Zealand called Manuka honey, which is antiviral, antifungal, and it's really, really powerful in terms of healing. Before I bring on my guest, Dr. Mary Newport, I want to talk to you about a DVD I've done called Instant Headache and Hangover Relief. It uses a Japanese pressure technique called shiatsu that you can do on yourself and others. And with it, you can get rid of a headache in 90 seconds. Migraines, 5 minutes. Sinus cold, stiff neck and sore shoulders. And you can even purchase the treatments individually at my website. You just go to migraineandheadache.com. Migraineandheadache.com.
My guest today is Dr. Mary Newport. Dr. Newport grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. She received an honors Bachelor of Arts degree from Xavier University, and then she graduated from University of Cincinnati College of Medicine in 1978. She trained in pediatrics at Children's Hospital Medical Center in Cincinnati and neonatology, the care of sick and premature newborns, at the Medical University Hospital in Charleston, South Carolina. She's the founding medical director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at Spring Hill Regional Hospital, and she's practicing there as a member of the All Children's Johns Hopkins Specialty Physicians Group. She's been married to her husband, Steve Newport, since 1972, and this is where, from her medical background, things changed because she wound up becoming his caregiver because he suffered from early-onset Alzheimer's disease. And in 2008, she wrote an article, What If There Was a Cure for Alzheimer's Disease and Nobody Knew? She then wrote a full book, which was released in October 2011, Alzheimer's Disease, What If There Was a Cure, The Story of Ketones. And she's been an invited lecturer on the subject at the Alzheimer's Disease International Conference and a number of other conferences as well. So, Dr. Newport, welcome to Healthy Alternatives.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program.
So how old was your husband, and what symptoms did you first notice when he started developing Alzheimer's?
Yeah, Steve actually worked from home as an accountant for my practice, and he took care of our children as they were growing up there. And when he was about age 51, he started having problems with making payroll mistakes and then procrastinating on getting tax reports done, you know, that were not like him at all. And then within about a year, he started having trouble remembering if he'd been to the bank and the post office, which didn't seem at all normal for somebody who was 51, 52 years old. So he was depressed at that point, and the doctor thought that, he mentioned dementia, but he thought it was more likely due to depression, that he was having memory issues. And so that's kind of where things started.
Now, you really can't diagnose Alzheimer's until somebody's actually died. Is that still correct, or has that changed?
It's changing a little bit. There's something called a beta amyloid PET scan that can be done when they do an autopsy on someone with Alzheimer's. What they're looking for is a large accumulation of this beta amyloid plaque and these tangles that are like the ghosts of neurons that have died, like the skeleton of the neuron. The beta amyloid PET scan now can show if there's a large accumulation of beta amyloid in the brain, which could help support a diagnosis if you're seeing somebody with symptoms, and it might be predictive for somebody that's at risk by virtue of their family history or their genetic profile. So it's not an absolute. There are some people that have a large amount of beta amyloid and have no symptoms at all, and there are some people that don't have much beta amyloid, but clinically they seem to have symptoms of Alzheimer's, so it's not an absolute, and that's even true with autopsy. It's not 100%.
Now, you said he started with what they called early onset. What does that actually mean in terms of Alzheimer's?
That's when someone is younger than 65 years old, it's considered early onset, and it's about 2% of people with Alzheimer's disease that are in the early onset group.
So it's talking more about an age and not symptoms particularly.
Right, right.
Okay. Now, there's a concept of Alzheimer's as kind of diabetes of the brain or a diabetes like a type 3. Can you explain what that concept means?
Right, right. A lot of people, including physicians, are not very familiar with this. They know about plaques and tangles, but they don't know about the problem of diabetes of the brain. And what's going on is for something like at least 10 to 20 years before a person develops symptoms, they start having decreased glucose uptake in the brain. And this happens because they have a deficiency of insulin and also a problem with insulin resistance. It has to do with the insulin receptors not being where they're supposed to be on the surface of the brain. Insulin is what allows glucose to get into the cell. So if there's a problem with insulin, the cell is not going to get energy. And that's true whenever, you know, basically with our standard American diet, you know, most of us have a relatively high carbohydrate diet, and we use glucose most of the time to feed ourselves. But if you go into starvation mode, you can switch over to use of ketones as an alternative fuel. So that's what we're going to be talking about here.
Okay, and so you came across a dietary treatment to help your husband with his Alzheimer's in 2008. Can you tell my listeners what happened?
Right, right. Yeah, Steve was on a downward spiral, I felt, in 2007, 2008. He was having a lot of physical symptoms. He couldn't physically run anymore. He walked strangely. He had very halting speech. He couldn't complete thoughts and finish sentences. And he could no longer do any accounting whatsoever. He couldn't use a computer or calculator, do simple math. And so, you know, he was very much going downhill at that point. And he was going to screen for two clinical trials. He had screened for one of them early in May of 2008. And one of the items that you have to do is score at least 16 or above on a 30-point memory test called the Mini Mental Status Exam. And he scored only 12, so he didn't qualify for the study because of that. He qualified in every other respect, and we were very disappointed. And then 2 weeks later, we scheduled back-to-back screenings for two different clinical trials, and both of these were the purpose of the drug was to remove beta amyloid plaque from the brain, which at that point was thought to be the cause of Alzheimer's disease by many groups studying this. So the night before the first screening, I thought it might be a good idea to look at the risks and benefits of these two drugs just in case he scored better and was accepted into both of these clinical trials. You can only be in one clinical trial at a time. So as I was looking up online the risks and benefits of these drugs, I came upon a third treatment that at that point was called AC1202. And it said that it improved the memories of people with Alzheimer's, about half of them, in the studies that they had done. And you don't really hear that at all about Alzheimer's drugs. You hear that they slow down the course of the disease, possibly by 6 months or so, but you don't hear it improves memory. So I was very curious, and it didn't really say in the press release what this was. And so I did an internet search for it, and I found their patent application on a website called Free Patents Online. You can look up any patent application there. And it had a very lengthy description of this concept of diabetes of the brain, which I really was not very familiar with at that point. And then it talked about the use of alternative fuels for the brain. You know, since the brain can't get glucose, ketones can serve as an alternative fuel. And this happens if you go into starvation. After 36, 48 hours, you use up the glucose that you have stored in your body, and your brain and other organs can readily switch over to using ketones as an alternative fuel. This happens in newborns, the first phase of life. And basically anyone, you know, our ancestors and a lot of people today have periods of feast and famine. And during those periods of famine, they do switch over to using ketones, and that's what keeps you alive. And normally where they come from is the breakdown of the fat you have in your body. You know, some of your organs, like your muscle and your heart, can use fatty acids, but then some of the fatty acid is converted in the liver to ketone bodies, and that crosses into the brain and can be used by the brain as a fuel. Well, what this company had had a brilliant insight was in relation to another type of oil that could be eaten that can produce the same effect, and this is medium-chain triglyceride oils, or MCT oil. When you
Dr. Newport, and that's without having to fast? In other words, you give it the oil instead of having to fast. Okay.
Right, without having to fast. You take MCT oil, and you don't need digestive enzymes. It's absorbed very easily, and it's taken up into the liver, and part of it is converted to ketones. And then the rest of the medium-chain triglyceride is released into the bloodstream, and it's not stored as fat. It's used immediately as energy by mitochondria in the muscle and probably even in the brain. So the medium-chain triglycerides themselves might also be an alternative fuel, and this needs to be studied more. This, you know, one time in their patent application, in parenthesis, it mentioned that MCT oil was derived from coconut oil, and that was news to me. And I was familiar with MCT oil because I'm a neonatologist. We used to add it to the feedings of our newborns, our tiny newborns, back in the late 70s, early 80s, to try to help them gain weight. And then they began created premature formulas, and they include MCT oil and coconut oil in virtually every infant formula. If you look at the label, you'll see that. And part of the reason for that is that breast milk contains something like 10 to 17% of the fatty acids as medium-chain triglycerides. So there's some reason why, you know, this is available to the newborn, and, you know, perhaps they're important, you know, for us as we get older, too. So this company, you know, basically, I didn't know it at the time, but MCT oil was available over the counter as well. You know, when I found this press release, it was about 1 a.m. and a screening was set for 9 a.m. And he, we had to go to the screening, and I didn't have time to research any more, much less did we have coconut oil at home. So
right, just on your shelf.
right. So he went for the screening, and he scored only 14 out of 30 again, and he did not qualify. He needed 16 to qualify, and we were quite devastated. The doctor had him draw a clock. There's something called the clock test for Alzheimer's, and it wasn't organized at all. It was several little circles and a few numbers just kind of scattered around. It really didn't look like a clock, and the doctor told me that he was on the verge of severe Alzheimer's, and that was eye-opening and devastating. So on the way home, I thought, what do we have to lose? I'm going to pick up some coconut oil. So we actually went about an hour out of the way to the only place I had ever remembered seeing it, and we picked it up and brought it home, and then, you know, I researched, I had to go through biochemistry 101 to remind myself what are the medium chain fatty acids. And then I was able to find the fatty acid composition of coconut oil on a government website, the USDA website, and figure out that 60% of the fats in coconut oil are these medium chain triglycerides. So, you know, I calculated based on the dose of this AC1202, which was 20 grams, how much coconut oil he would need, and it was 35 grams, which is a little over 2 tablespoons. So the next morning then, he was scheduled for his screening at 1 in the afternoon, and I put the coconut oil in oatmeal because coconut oil tends to be a little solid at room temperature, and it melted down, and he ate it without any problem. And when we went to the screening, he actually scored this time 18 out of 30, and he qualified for the trial. And one of the studies that they had done with this medium-chain triglyceride oil to get FDA approval was a single-dose study, and almost half the people improved on their cognitive testing with just one dose. So I was actually quite surprised and pleased, but at the time I wasn't sure it was a coconut oil or just good luck. And so we kept it going and every day, and then I started cooking with it. You know, he would get a measured dose at breakfast, and then I would cook with it the rest of the day. I was researching recipes and everything else. And
Dr. Newport, let me interrupt for a second because I got to take a break, and we'll come back in a second and pick up further. So before we continue, I'd like to remind you, you're listening to Healthy Alternatives, Dr. Jerry Teplitz, and we'll be back with my guest, Dr. Mary Newport, in just a moment.
I want to talk to you about a book I've done called Switched On Selling with Dr. Tony Alessandra. It was a number one bestseller on Amazon. It's a book, if you're involved with any kind of selling, will switch your brain on to be able to succeed in ways you never thought possible. If you're having difficulty struggling with sales, you want to take a look at getting this book, you can go to switchedonselling.com, or you can find it on Amazon.
So my guest today is Dr. Mary Newport. She has a MD from University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She trained in pediatrics, and she also was the founding medical director of the Newborn Intensive Care Unit at Spring Hill Regional Hospital. And there she was a member of the All Children's John Hopkins Specialty Physicians Group. And she's been working with her husband, Steve Newport, who had early onset Alzheimer's. And she's actually written the book in 2011, Alzheimer's Disease, What If There Was a Cure? And we've been talking to her about the impact that taking coconut oil had on her husband. So would you go into more of the improvements that you saw now that you started him on taking this?
Right. So, you know, first he ended up qualifying for a study that he couldn't qualify for before, so he could get into a clinical trial, which gave us great hope. But then as we continued it every day, what we saw was a change in he, instead of being very sluggish in the morning and not very talkative, he started coming out alert and talkative and more animation in his face. His personality came back, a sense of humor came back. And over about a 4 or 5 day period, when it persisted, you know, we both looked at each other and said, we feel like our life has changed. And he told me that it felt like the light switch came back on that day, that the fog lifted from his brain, and that he had a future. He was very depressed at that point, and the depression lifted almost completely over a matter of several weeks. And then over a couple of months, there were some changes. We started to see virtually no tremor. He was having tremors in his jaw and his hand when he would try to eat. That virtually disappeared. He was able to start running again, just physically pick up his feet and run, started walking normally again. He had had a visual disturbance that had kept him from being able to read a book. He was an avid reader of novels, but he would, he said, he was able to describe it to me at that point. He said it was like the words on the page had gone into pixels and were moving around on the page, and so he really could not focus on the words because they were moving, and this stopped after about 3 or 4 months. He realized that it had stopped, and that has never returned. And he actually did enter into a clinical trial. At the time, you know, it was a dietary intervention. He'd been on it for a couple months, and the company was not concerned that it would affect their results. So they decided to let him be in this clinical trial. And we learned about a year ago that he was actually in the placebo part of this trial for the first 12 to 14 months. And so all of the testing that was done on him during that first year, we can say was not from the drug in the clinical trial because he was on placebo. And what we saw was that he improved. There's a longer memory test called the Alzheimer's Disease Assessment Scale that's 75 points. And he actually improved by 6 points over a year. And while other people on placebo dropped by a little over 6 points.
So you basically screwed up the study, lady, huh?
I screwed up the study, yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I screwed up the study. And there's another test called the Activities of Daily Living, and you know, which really is more quality of life related. And he gained 14 points out of 78 points on that test over a year. And that's exactly what we saw. It was much easier for him to do things just by himself, you know, personal hygiene, you know, showering, dressing, picking out his clothes. He did so much better. He wanted to get a job, and that didn't seem very practical at that point, but he was able to start volunteering at the hospital that I work at. He helped out in the warehouse. He put stickers on supplies and helped move heavy boxes and that kind of thing, and he was able to do that for about another year and a half, you know, after, you know, this happened. So it really brought about a tremendous improvement in his quality of life, and for both him and me, as a caregiver, Alzheimer's just a horrific disease, and you know, any improvement at all is, you know, something that you're very grateful for.
Now, have you heard similar types of improvements from other people that have been taking
Right. So when I wrote the article you mentioned in July 08, it was for the purpose of getting this message out. The company making the medical food, it was going to be a prescription medical food, and it was still at least a year away from coming out. And at that point, I knew also that MCT oil was available over the counter. And it's not very expensive. I just got some recently for $9 a quart on Amazon, you know. Basically, after I put out this article, it started circulating locally at first, and then the St. Petersburg Times, now called the Tampa Bay Times here in Florida, ran an article about it, and then it really got out on the Internet. You know, so then in late 2008, early 2009, I started hearing back from other people who had tried this. And since then, I've accumulated about 220 case reports from people, you know, who have emailed me about improvements in their loved ones. About 185 of them are people with dementia, you know, usually Alzheimer's-type dementia, but also people with Parkinson's disease, Huntington's chorea, Lou Gehrig's disease, several children with autism, for example, a middle-aged lady with Down syndrome. And people with Down syndrome will virtually all develop Alzheimer's disease if they make it to middle age.
I even remember seeing you saying something that you can use it to stop herpes from flaring.
Right. And that's the thing about coconut oil. It contains one of the medium-chain triglycerides is called lauric acid, and it's one of the components of breast milk that they say helps protect a newborn from infection. And lauric acid dissolves the lipid capsule of certain viruses, such as the herpes virus and even the HIV virus. And it kills bacteria, it kills fungus such as candida, protozoa, so it's an antimicrobial type of fat. And Steve and a lot of people who are his genotype suffer from recurrent fever blisters. They seem to have some problem in their immune system where they have recurrent fever blisters. And these are usually caused by herpes simplex virus type 1. Mm-hmm. And the thing about this is that the virus lays dormant in the nerve, and these nerves originate in the brain near the areas that are affected by Alzheimer's disease. So and there's a group in England that's been studying this for years, and they have found that the beta amyloid plaques, about 90% of them, contain the DNA of the herpes virus. So the plaques might actually be a response to an infection, and that's why there's so much of it in people with Alzheimer's, because, you know, they're dealing with an infection in the brain. So coconut oil could potentially help reduce the number of flare-ups, and we did see that with Steve. He was constantly having fever blisters, and they would last for, you know, 10 to 14 days or even longer before it would go away, and then he'd be free of it for a week or two, and then it would come back, and he just had a lifelong history of that. And after we started the coconut oil, we saw two tiny outbreaks over about a year, which was an amazing improvement, you know, as far as that goes.
Now, is there a difference between taking coconut oil versus taking the MCT oil? Is there a benefit of one versus the other?
Yeah, what we actually do is mix them. We cook with coconut oil, but for Steve, he's getting at least three and often four doses a day of a combination of MCT oil and coconut oil. And one of the reasons I do that is that when we tested his levels of ketones after he took MCT oil, the peak level was higher than with coconut oil, but they were gone after about 3 hours. There were no ketones left after 3 hours. So this medical food, for example, is approved for only one dose a day. So you have 21 hours a day without basically ketones circulating. And I have heard from people that, you know, into the afternoon, if they took a morning dose, that they become foggier again. So how
much would a dose be?
Steve, at this point, is getting about 3 tablespoons, 3 times a day of this mixture. And then at bedtime, we usually give him about 2 tablespoons.
And with, is there a particular kind of coconut oil? Because I know there are different, I've seen some literature that says some use heat, some use chemicals, some don't. Have you seen any difference in the quality of the coconut oil that you need to be aware of?
As far as the ketone effect, it shouldn't matter too much, but I've always kind of had a feeling that there were other things in coconut oil that might be helping this. So as far as the various types of coconut oil, there might be something in organic, unrefined coconut oil that is helping enhance this effect that we're seeing. Some, like refined coconut oils, do have a considerable amount of processing, and they have a lot of nutrients removed, you know, during that processing. And so our preference is to use organic, unrefined coconut oil.
Are there any clinical trials going on using coconut oil at this point, or the MCT oil?
Axona is actually, they have two large studies going on now. Axona is the name of the medical food now, when it was given a name, and it has been out since about May of 2009. So they have two large studies going on now. I think they're trying to go all the way and get approved as a drug by the FDA. The University of South Florida here in Tampa, the Bird Alzheimer Institute, is planning a study. It's going to take place pretty much any time now, and it's in people with mild cognitive impairment. And they're going to give them coconut oil with a little MCT oil added to see if it will improve their symptoms and also prevent progression of Alzheimer's disease, which happens in people with mild cognitive impairment often.
Great.
So, and I am aware also of another study that's going to take place in Maryland, too, a similar kind of study.
So for listeners who would like to learn more about what Dr. Mary Newport's talking about, you can look at getting her book. It's Alzheimer's Disease, What If There Was a Cure? The Story of Ketones. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Nobles. And you can also go to her website to get it. It's Coconut Ketones. Ketones is ketones.com. She has also got a blog, coconutketones.blogspot.com. www.diethealthcare.com. And there she's got a lot of information and free diet guidelines as well that you can take a look at. Dr. Newport, thanks for being a guest today on Healthy Alternatives.
Oh, thank you for having me and helping me to spread the message.
My guest next week is Dr. Eben Alexander. He's been an academic neurosurgeon for the last 25 years, including having spent 15 years at Brigham and Women's and the Children's Hospital and also Harvard Medical School in Boston. He's got a long academic career. He's authored, co-authored many articles, done several hundred presentations at conferences, but then he had an experience where he almost died, and he had a transcendental near-death experience. And going from being a neurosurgeon to having a near-death experience is a fascinating story we're going to talk to him about. He was recently interviewed on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday about his experience and his book, Proof of Heaven. So you're not going to want to miss this one. This is Dr. Jerry Teplitz. You can find out more about me at teplitz.com, or you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today for Healthy Alternatives. For more information about Dr. Teplitz and his availability for speaking engagements, please click on the globe on the webtalkradio.net page in front of you, or go to teplitz.com. You may also follow him on Facebook and Twitter by using the icons on the page. To find out more about his books, please click on any of the book covers you see. Eat well, rest well, take a breath, get some exercise, and we'll see you again right here next week for another edition of Healthy Alternatives.